The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, December 27, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps. Well, actually, not live. No. Sorry. I lied. Live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, it's vacation time, folks. It's vacation time, and it's the last week of 2017. You know what that means. Best ofs all this week on the Majority Report. Now we're going to throw you a curveball. You're thinking like, oh, okay. I get it. Best of 2017. That means the best of shows of 2017, right? So today is a show going to be one of the best from 2017, right? Wrong. Tricked you. We had a lot of people who said, we want to hear Stephanie Kelton. She is now a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University. But we had her on in September. And I thought, oh, a lot of people listened to her then. Maybe what we should do is have her on from the first time I think she was on. I think this is the first time. And it was May 22nd of 2014, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And at that time, she was the chair of Department of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And it was a similar interview. But I understand at that time, people were worried about hyperinflation. That was the big thing we were hearing. Oh, we're going to have hyperinflation. Better get your gold.
Why in 2014? I don't remember that.
Well, because it was still fresh from like the quantitative easing. And I think by that point, it was like Q2 or Q3. I'm not sure. QE2, I think it was. Quantitative easing number two. Now, look, there were problems with quantitative easing insofar as they gave the money to the wrong people. They gave it to the banks instead of giving it directly to the homeowners. Or just frankly, dropping it out of a helicopter. But the problem was not, oh, we're going to have Weimar Republic inflation. It's going to cost me $1,000 to get a hot dog. And this is relevant because what Stephanie Kelton is going to tell you, which is a theory that has gained a lot more traction, frankly, since 2014, is that deficits in and of themselves do not matter. That national debt for a country such as ours, which has control over its currency, which is whose currency is so widely accepted around the world, and whose economy is fundamentally sound, if not just. And it's, I mean, let's face it, it's not just. I mean, it goes, but the amount of resources that it's generating, you know, makes us a fairly stable economy. And she's going to explain to you, if you do not understand this concept, of why there is an inverse proportion between the government's debt and private debt. And if you want the private sector to have more money, you want the government to actually have a deficit. What? That's not what we've been told. We've been told that when the deficit goes up, we're going to have to cut taxes and tighten our belt and sit around the kitchen table. Like everybody in the country, there's going to be a huge kitchen table. There's going to be 300 million people sitting around it. And daddy is going to tell us we're going to have to cut back, folks. That's just not the way it works. And this has important implications. Because as much of a crap show as this Republican tax bill is, because it redistributes the money in such a way that it concentrates it in very few hands. There's a lot of problems associated with that. Economic and political problems associated with it. But the one problem is not that it's going to increase the deficit. It's that it's going to increase the deficit because we're spending money on stuff that is not necessary. In other words, tax cuts for wealthy people. What we should do is increase the deficit, fine, that same amount, but spend it on free college. Spend it on Medicare for all. Spend it on infrastructure improvements, education, I mean, a myriad of things. All right, well, so here is Professor Stephanie Kelton from 2014 going to explain to you that what you think about you, what you think you know about money is in fact wrong. And after that, we'll have some of the best of fun half stuff for you. Matt picks. All right, enjoy. On the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, also Editor-in-Chief of the blog New Economic Perspectives. She also hosts a her own podcast, which you should check out, on MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. Stephanie Kelton, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks so much. Glad to be back.
I want to cover some of the stuff that we talked about. I guess it was now almost 2 years ago in covering some of the basics about modern monetary theory. Now, when we spoke last time, we were dealing with things like the fiscal cliff and the threat by the Republicans to not pay our debt obligations. It's a different time in some respects and not in more important respects. And specifically, the deficit is about half of where it was or pretty close when we spoke. Yet our economic situation, which flies in the face of everything we were told by all of these the great thinkers in Washington, was that our economic situation has not changed in many respects. And so before we get to that, let's just go back and explain this notion of how we're living in a different era in terms of our monetary policy. But we have yet to sort of adjust to that. So let's go back and just... let's talk about Bretton Woods for a moment. What is Bretton Woods? When did that happen? And what has changed since then?
Sure. So Bretton Woods was an international monetary system that was set up after World War II. And the basic thinking was that, you know, the world needed some stability after the war, and that what we ought to do is set up a system where we had fixed exchange rates. So what you had were 44 countries coming together and agreeing to participate in this construction and creation of this monetary system set up to fix the value of one country's currency relative to another country's currency. And so what happened is 43 countries said, we agree it's going to be the U.S. dollar. We'll all fix our currencies to the value of the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll agree to convert dollars into gold at a fixed price. And so it was a form of a gold standard system, a fixed exchange rate system, and it was in place, as you said, from 1944, from the end of the war, all the way up until Nixon ended it in 1971. So we went from a system of fixed exchange rates, where one country's currency exchanged for another country's currency at a fixed price and threw the U.S. dollar into gold at a fixed price, to a system where most currencies in the world today are what we call floating currencies. They're no longer fixed to another country's currency or a basket of currencies or gold or anything else. They the value of the currency changes from day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute in financial markets. So it's a very different type of monetary system that we have today.
That's right, because when we went off gold in 1971, everything changed. But in some respects, we have yet to really, our policymakers have yet to really adjust to that new world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that there has been a full appreciation. In fact, I think it's pretty clear there hasn't been a full appreciation of the magnitude, the significance of that change, and what it means for policy. So, I mean, I think in terms of the policy space that's available to us, and the policy space was just a whole lot smaller on a gold standard, on a fixed exchange rate system, than it is today now that we're off of that type of system. So we have degrees of freedom available to us that we didn't have under the old monetary arrangements, but we still, because we fail to appreciate that, we act like we're still trapped in an old gold standard framework. You know, it's sort of like the textbooks that were written in the 60s and 50s, where we had that monetary system in place, haven't really been revised a whole lot since then. We sort of repeat the same sorts of stories about the way the economy works and the way government budgets work and so forth, not recognizing that things changed in 71 and we should rewrite the textbooks, because it really does make a whole lot of difference in terms of, you know, the policy options that are available.
All right, so let's talk about those policy options. I mean, what specifically did it free us up to do, and what we're not taking advantage of?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is that when you're pledging to convert your currency, so let's just talk about the U.S. If you're pledging to convert your currency on demand at a fixed price into gold, which is itself something that's finite, then you have to be pretty careful about how much spending you do, how big your deficits get, and so forth, you know, the type of monetary policy that you run. Because if you start creating too much of your own currency and people want to convert the currency into gold, but there's only so much gold available, then you can undermine the very foundation of your monetary system. So you've got to be pretty careful about how much you actually spend and how aggressive your monetary policy is and so forth when you're on a system like that. Now, today, because the government doesn't pledge to convert dollars into anything else, it doesn't have to be careful in the same way that it did on a gold standard. It still has to be careful because, of course, you can still get an inflation problem. So what the government can do today that it couldn't do back then is focus exclusively on how much it's adding in terms of spending in the economy relative to how much demand it's taking away by taxing, and it can target economic goals like full employment with a mind only to the inflationary effects in the real economy and not having to worry about whether it's got enough of this shiny yellow metal to support its monetary system.
Okay, now this is weedy stuff. So I want to sort of
sure.
I want to go back over this so that people really understand this concept. When essentially our dollars were certificates for redemption of gold, it limited the amount that we could print essentially of dollars, because that day that somebody could come in and say, all the people who have those certificates could come back and say, I want to redeem my certificate. And if we don't have the gold to back that up, we're in big trouble. And like you say, gold is a finite resource. So we can still have inflation. But tell us how inflation was created in that scenario. Tell us what the danger was. Like, what would happen back when we were on the gold standard if that came to pass, where people say, I want the gold now?
Mm-hmm. So, well, what happens is if governments are promising to convert their currency into something else, and there's only so much of that thing, then what happens when people start demanding the underlying asset, they want the gold or they want somebody else's currency, the government tries to protect its foreign exchange reserves, its gold or the other country's currency or whatever. And the way that it tries to protect it is by offering people an alternative. So the government could say, look, don't convert your dollars into gold because we're worried that we're running out of gold. We don't want you to do that. How about instead you agree to convert your dollars into U.S. Treasuries? And people say, no, we don't want to convert to treasuries. We really want gold. And the government says, well, no, I really think you should take the treasury. Look here, I'll pay you more interest. It makes it more appealing. I say, well, no, I still really think I want the gold. Well, how about if I offer this interest rate? And so interest rates become the tool that government uses to try to protect its reserve asset, whether it's gold or somebody else's currency. And so that's the real danger, is that you lose control of the interest rate. And so, you know, interest rates start going up, and then all of a sudden you get all sorts of problems in your economy because people won't borrow and spend at higher rates of interest. And so what it liberates you from, having a currency that's not convertible, not tied to gold or some other country's currency, is that it frees governments from having to use their interest rates as a mechanism to compete with the ability of people to convert their dollars into something else. And so you can keep interest rates low. You can try to provide the right climate for, you know, borrowers and folks and businesses or households to borrow at low interest rates and buy homes or cars or refrigerators or whatever it is. It's supposed to be a better tool for central banks to be able to, you know, kind of tweak the economy by making these modest adjustments in interest rates over time and not completely losing control of interest rates because they're trying to protect gold reserves.
So, in other words, the government does not have to automatically worry about printing more money. It is in other words, they don't have to worry about they don't have to fight on two fronts in some ways, right? They don't have to worry about their rear guard in terms of what they have for gold. They just have to worry about what the situation is in the economy.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It frees them of the need to obsess over the foreign exchange reserves or the gold reserves. That's exactly right.
And so when people, you know, I was sitting in a green room with David Stockman. Now, let's refrain from sort of from judging from judging from whence he comes to formulate his opinions. But he was one of those people who are just like, it is all going to come crashing down. We have the another round of quantitative easing, and we're going to turn into Weimar Republic. We're going to turn into Zimbabwe. Explain to us what happened with Weimar, the Weimar Republic, and what happened with Zimbabwe, and why that's not a problem for us in the circumstance we are in now.
Okay. So Stockman's concern, of course, is sort of widely held. And lots of people looked at what the Fed was doing and cried hyperinflation, Weimar, and all that sort of stuff because their models tell them so. So, you know, in economics, people sometimes put their hand over their heart when they hear the name Milton Friedman. And, you know, the models that were taught in economics are that if you increase the money supply or the rate of growth of the money supply, you get proportionate increases in prices or in the inflation rate. And so people just anticipate that's the way it's supposed to work. So they saw the Fed doing QE, and it looks like printing money, and their, you know, hearts tell them, well, if the Fed is printing money, we're going to get inflation. If they're printing lots of money, we're going to get high inflation or hyperinflation. And then they make, you know, these analogies to Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe. So what happened, you know, I'm not a historian, but I've studied this a little bit, and with Germany, what you had was, of course, Germany loses the war, is paying reparations, so there are war reparations. Germany's trying to acquire gold in order to pay reparations, and so they're printing lots of Deutschmarks to buy gold. At the same time, you have the French and the Belgians come in and occupy a big section of the industrial production facilities in Germany. And so you have the sort of old Milton Friedman problem of too much money chasing too few goods, which results in inflation. But the reason you have too much money is not because you have some technocrat trying to, you know, manage the economy and achieve full employment, but because you're printing Deutschmarks to buy gold to pay reparations, and then you've lost a part of your productive capacity, so you can't produce the goods and services that money is now going to chase. And so very complex sort of thing going on there. It's not the good old-fashioned, you know, an economy that gets overheated in normal times that generates inflation. It's happening on the supply side, and it's much more complex. sort of a thing going on. And in the case of Zimbabwe, you know, you have Mugabe come to power, and one of the things he does is redistribute land, and he takes land away from white farmers and redistributes it to black farmers with little and, in many cases, no farming experience. And so what ends up happening is that you get food shortages. And again, you know, this is not the kind of thing that you get because the Fed is doing QE. You've got all sorts of stuff happening on the supply side of the economy that allows too much money to end up with too few goods to chase. So there are ways to explain hyperinflation, but there's an interesting study that was done, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I think, by two economists from the Cato Institute. So this is a, you know, libertarian think tank. And it was the study was done by a guy named Steve Hanke, and I always forget the other guy's name, but they spent 3 years doing this research. And they said, okay, what we want to do is we want to understand what causes hyperinflation. So we're going to do this comprehensive study where we look at every single case of hyperinflation that has ever occurred on planet Earth, and we want to study it and understand what caused it. And they found 56 cases of hyperinflation anywhere in the world ever in the history of time. And then they did an analysis, said, okay, in this case it was caused by this, in this case it was caused by this. And the most interesting thing about their study is not what it shows or reveals, but what isn't there. And what isn't there is in none of those cases, 56 examples, you'd never have had hyperinflation in an otherwise well-functioning democracy. You get hyperinflation when you have, you know, a civil breakdown, you have a coup, you have the loss of a war, you have supply-side shocks like the, you know, food that I mentioned in Zimbabwe. There's always something more complex going on than just that simple printing money story that most people, I think, have in their heads.
And as far as I understand the way you're explaining it, in Germany, they were printing money for the sake of getting buying gold, and and so the causal connection was sort of reversed in some way as to why they were printing money. They weren't printing money to drive demand, because demand was already there. What wasn't there was the ability to meet that demand, and that's back into your story. And that's so having addressed that, let's talk about we came through this financial crisis, or we're still in the wake of this financial crisis. There was all these pushing for austerity, which I think I hope at least now has been largely debunked as a response to dealing with this big output gap, right? I mean, because we didn't have the what happened is the demand basically went away in that instance. And so what we should have been doing during that time, and I would argue probably still, is increasing demand. And so tell us how that would, I mean, how would with the knowledge of modern monetary theory, how would we have responded to this crisis differently?
Well, I'm not even sure that you need modern monetary theory to get the right policy response. I think, you know, just understanding essentially Keynesian economics, the philosophy there would be what you just said, which is if you've got an output gap, the indication is that there's not enough total spending in the economy to buy all the stuff that businesses are capable of producing. If you want to get back to full employment, you've got to increase spending. And so where MMT comes in handy, I think, is in allowing you to recognize how much policy space is available so that you don't, out of one side of your mouth, talk about advocating for more spending and more aggressive fiscal policy, and out of the other side of your mouth, you're worrying about what's going to happen to the deficit and, you know, talking about the need to balance budgets longer term. So, you know, looking at the economy and what happened after the Great Recession, you're seeing an economy that was hemorrhaging jobs. I mean, at one point we were losing close to 800,000 jobs a month. So why do workers lose their jobs? Well, they lose their jobs because firms are laying them off. And why do they do that? Well, because they don't have the customers buying their goods and services at a price that will turn a profit for them. And so it's pretty straightforward if capitalism runs on sales. And so the way to stem the loss there is to make sure that there are customers in the stores, that you've got the sales, because it's sales that that firms are looking for. And when sales return robustly, business, that's the clearest indication to businesses that it's safe to start hiring and investing again. So what would we have done? Well, I think probably much more aggressive. My colleagues and I were calling very early on in 2009 for a full payroll tax holiday. So, you know, this is the most direct way to put money in the hands of those who are most likely to spend it. So you've got about 151 million Americans working for a living and paying into Social Security. If we had reduced payroll tax withholdings, that FICA that you see on your paycheck, if we had just reduced that to zero for a period of time, it would have resulted in something close to $300 more a month in take-home pay for the average worker. You're looking at, you know, close to $700 a month for a couple making just a little bit above the average, and that's significant. So, you know, we were looking at an economy where the private sector was trying to deleverage. Households had too much debt, and many people were not going to go out and start borrowing and spending and kickstart the economy. They wanted to pay down debt. So payroll tax holiday would be great for something like that. Put the money back in the hands of the people, and they will do one of two things. Probably they will pay down debt if they're struggling with high debt levels, and those who weren't would go out and spend some or most of that income. And so, you know, that's something that we would have done. We would have been more aggressive on aid to state and local governments, recognizing that state governments aren't like the federal government. They don't issue the currency, and they are dependent upon the ability to collect taxes and borrow in order to spend, and most of them have to balance their budgets. And so we would have been much more aggressive there in assisting state and local governments. And then finally, we like the idea of a jobs program modeled on the old New Deal programs like the WPA to CCC, the National Youth Administration, where, you know, for those folks who didn't find employment after the other programs were put in place, well, you offer a job for anybody who's ready, willing, and able to work, but not able to find work in the economy, and you do what Roosevelt did. You now, create employment opportunities for them.
Now, I should say that I'm contractually obligated to myself to say that I had a political problem with a moratorium on payroll taxes, simply mm-hmm. because and I think there were a lot of others who felt this way, that this would end up being a very good argument that for those who look to cut Social Security benefits, that we need to cut Social Security benefits because of this moratorium. I would have much preferred the sort of the George Bush style. We're sending to everybody, we've collected your taxes, mm-hmm. now we're going to give you a rebate from the general fund. That's more of a political question than it is an economic one. Now, the reason why we didn't do those things was because people were so concerned about the deficit and the debt here. And explain to people how in a time where we have such a low demand, that when the government actually shrinks its deficit and then ultimately begins to shrink its debt, this is taking money out of people's hands.
Okay, so, you know, let's take an example and put some numbers to it, because I think it might be more helpful that way. If I say the government is spending $100 into the economy, and they're taking 90 out by collecting taxes, then we label that a deficit. The government is running a deficit of 10. And we're so accustomed to thinking in terms of the deficit as being something that's undesirable and something, you know, it's something that's wrong and it ought to be fixed, that we forget that the 10 goes somewhere. If they spend 100 in and they take 90 out, somebody else ended up with the 10. And the 10 shows up in the non-government part of the economy. And so the government's deficit is, I like to call it the accounting record of a surplus somewhere else in the economy. But we don't think of it as a surplus because we forget about the other side of the balance sheet. And that's a real problem, you know. So we talk about, you know, Simpson-Bowles, and we say, well, Simpson-Bowles has a plan to reduce the government's deficit by $4.1 trillion over the next 10 years. People say, well, that sounds great, right? That's massive deficit reduction. Good for us. And then if you say the sentence differently and you say Simpson-Bowles has a plan to reduce non-government surpluses by $4.1 trillion over the next 10 years. People would say, why would they do that? That doesn't sound like a very good idea. Why would you want to reduce non-government surpluses? But they're identical statements. They're just looked at from two different sides of the ledger. And so it's a real problem getting, I think, doing the education that's required to allow people to feel more empowered in these discussions about the need to reduce deficits, because since everybody is so convinced that deficits are a bad thing and it's in our national interest to reduce them, I mean, people go so far as to saying they're, you know, the deficit is the greatest threat to national security or something. Well, I mean, God, any patriotic American would then say, okay, well, what do we have to do to get rid of the threat? And then, you know, our public officials tell us, well, we need shared sacrifice. And we say, well, okay, you know, I'm willing to do my part because I love my country, so let's get that deficit down.
Now, the interesting thing is that there really isn't a government economy and a private economy, right? I mean, there's the economy, and there's, you could say, there's a government sector, and you could say there's a private sector, but you could also say there's also a healthcare sector. There's also a, a building cars sector, I guess. I mean, that seems to be the problem, is that people don't, there's this sense that if the government takes your taxes, that somehow that money goes, sort of evaporates into another plane of existence and does not end up back in somebody's hands somewhere. And that's a human being in our society who's theoretically going out to the same stores as anybody else.
Well, I mean, that happens when they spend it back in. That's what the spending part does. It puts it somewhere in the economy. But the taxing part definitely does remove it. I mean, it does, in a sense, evaporate, right? If they only collected the tax but they didn't spend it back in, then it's not going to show up anywhere else
right.
in the economy.
Right.
So you need those, right? You need those two things happening. So if they put in 100 and take out 90, then you've got 10 showing up somewhere.
Right. The problem is if you tax simply with the purpose of cutting your deficit and don't actually spend that money, that's where the problem is. And decoupling.
Sure.
Okay. And so
Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about the purposes of taxes, because there's a misunderstanding of why we need to collect taxes in this age if we are freed from a policy standpoint when we have a lack of demand in the economy. Tell us what the purposes of taxes are.
Well, taxes do a lot of things in the economy. They certainly have impacts and there are implications for the distribution of income, right? On whom taxes fall most heavily, where you collect and so forth, has distributional effects. But the one clear thing that taxes do is they take purchasing power by taking income away from someone. That's every dollar that is taxed away from you is a dollar that you don't have to do one of two things with, save or spend. And so taxes remove purchasing power from the economy. That's really important sort of thing that taxes do. This is something that, you know, used to be widely recognized by economists, by Fed chairs and so forth, that this gave the government a powerful lever that it could pull when it was trying to manage an overheating economy. And so if you began to see inflation because, you know, your economy was up against its constraints in terms of being able to produce more stuff, but demand was running really high, well, then government could grab that tax lever and pull on it and cool things off. So you raise taxes, you take away income, people spend less. And so that's really one of the most important different functions that taxes serve in the economy. And in contrast, if you're running, if your economy is running cold, then you just push the lever in the other direction. You leave more income in the hands of people who you think are most likely to go out and spend that additional income.
So just, I mean,
but we tend to think of taxes really differently, right? We think of taxes as the mechanism by which the government gets money, and that the federal government, in order to be able to spend dollars, has to get the dollars from somewhere. We think that they need to get them from us because we have the dollars and they don't. And so they come to us and collect the dollars and then they spend the dollars. But if you think about it, it really doesn't make any sense. I mean, the United States government has a monopoly on the creation of the currency. They are the monopoly issuer of the U.S. dollar. It can't come from anywhere else. You know, a lot of stuff's made in China, but not U.S. dollars. The United States government says we claim the sole authority to issue the United States dollar. And if you do it and get caught, well, that's called counterfeiting. So we create the currency. It comes from us. And so this idea that somehow governments are revenue constrained, that they can't spend until they first come find the dollar somewhere, have to go out and get it, you know, is really getting things quite backwards.
So just to clarify for people, when you say the economy runs hot, that is a function of demand outpacing supply. When it's cool, like we have now, supply outpaces demand. And it is that dynamic, the hot dynamic, which creates inflation, because if you have a lot of people who want to buy a car, then the guy selling the car is going to say, all right, I'll give it to the highest bidder. And prices go up that way. So taxes function to cool down an economy where the demand is outstripping the supply. We should also say that I think, I believe you agree with this. Taxes also give value to our money insofar as it gives value to the currency, because the government's saying we'll only accept no chickens, no sheep, no firstborn. We're only going to accept the money that we tender to pay off your taxes. So you owe this. And basically people go out and try and get money.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is something you can find that exact same argument that you just made in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And you can find it running, you know, all the way through hundreds of years later into the work of Nobel Prize winning economists like James Tobin or Paul Samuelson. It's not a really controversial idea, although it's not something that's usually emphasized by economists. But that's right. I mean, the government gets to declare how it's going to make its payments and in what form it's going to receive payments to itself. And we're all subject to tax obligations, and they get to tell us what we need to get in order to pay our taxes. And so the ability that the government has to make and enforce those tax laws gives value to whatever thing they say we have to have. And in the U.S., of course, it's the U.S. dollar. Like in Germany, when they had the Deutschmark, they asked the people in poll after poll, do you want to give up the Deutschmark and go for a common currency in a part of Europe? People said, absolutely not. We love the Deutschmark. We're never giving it up. It's so stable. We worked so hard to get here. No, we don't want any part of this monetary union thing. Well, it didn't matter, right, that they really loved the Deutschmark as soon as Germany said we're in, and henceforth we're only going to be making payments in euros, and we're only going to take euros in payment to us. Well, the euro suddenly had value, and everybody was willing to work for it and accept it and so forth. So, yes, I do agree with you.
All right, so let's turn to inequality. You tweeted the other day, I wonder if Hillary Clinton will run on a commitment to balancing the budget and addressing inequality and how that will turn out. Now, if she did so, she would not be unique, would be my guess. And in some respects, that is just sort of the conventional wisdom. So tell us why that's problematic. Obviously, you know, the last time we spoke, it was all there was a lot more talk about the debt and the deficit than there is now. And like I say, it's the deficit has been halved, and that hasn't quite brought us to nirvana. But people are far more conscious of inequality. Thomas Piketty's book is all the rage now. Why won't that work? Why are those two things at odds?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that happens when we start focusing our attention on deficit reduction is, you know, you pointed out earlier that there are lots of people who will look at Social Security and say, this is an unsustainable program. We've got to, you know, make tough choices and shared sacrifice and all that kind of stuff. We got to get entitlements under control. And if we were to do that and we bought into that, we said, okay, we're going to tackle this budget problem. We're going to pay down the debt. We're going to reduce the deficit to even, you know, further. And one of the big concerns is that we've got problems with entitlements. So we're going to tackle those tough choices. We're going to have to cut benefits. You know, we can't afford to keep promises that we've made to the elderly and their dependents and the disabled. So benefits come down. Well, that's going to have a huge impact on inequality, right? Because this is one of the most important programs. I'm talking about Social Security in terms of keeping the elderly out of poverty. So we start, my concern is that we would end up with something like that, where we start choosing to reform programs or adjust spending and taxes in a way that exacerbates inequality for the purpose of trying to balance the budget and so forth.
All right, so let's talk about inequality. I mean, the Piketty, and this has been the most criticized, I think, part of his book in some respects, suggests, and maybe somewhat offhandedly relative to the rest of his work, but that an international, I guess, a worldwide wealth tax would be the answer. Mm-hmm. You know, we spoke to Thomas Frank, I guess it was a week or two ago, and he was critical of that solution, and I imagine you are too. Tell us why, if that's the case.
No, I think you're right. I read Tom's review of Piketty, and I think it's probably my favorite of all the reviews I've read so far. And I think Tom's right. I mean, I don't know. With the global wealth tax, it just seems to me that getting something like that actually adopted and enforced, and there are so many ways through accounting maneuvers to avoid paying taxes. So that just seems to me, on a variety of fronts, probably the wrong way to go. And I think that Tom really hits the nail on the head, because he says, look, when inequality was not increasing rapidly, like what we're seeing today, this is the period of time where unions were most strong and most important in the economy. And so he was surprised, and I was surprised, that Tamad does not talk about the importance of strengthening labor, particularly bargaining through unionization. And so, you know, there are a variety of ways to go at inequality. You can, if you just think about, you know, put one hand up high, put one hand down low, and you say, I want to reduce inequality, so I'm going to tax the hell out of the people at the top. Well, that lowers them, and inequality comes down, but it doesn't do anything for the people on the bottom. So what could you do for those on the bottom? How can you address inequality and also make the majority better off? Well, you increase the incomes of those at the bottom. So inequality goes down, but you're helping 99% of the population. And so, you know, I mentioned it, the job guarantee program. But if we had something like that, and some people want to have a program that's really generous. You know, Sandy Darity has been proposing, he's at Duke, for a number of years, a federally funded jobs program where you have wages scaled. And he's got some pretty generous wages, you know, $50,000 and maybe even higher. But then you have a benefits package as well. So you can have, you know, wages and benefits that include health care, vacation time, child care. I mean, you can get as creative as you want with some of the stuff. This would do more to increase the well-being of those at the bottom, and then it would ratchet upward because, you know, depending on how aggressive you get, that becomes the de facto minimum. So any other employer in the economy who wants to hire a worker is going to have to compete with this wage and benefit package, and you can lift an awful lot of people up out of poverty, and I think deal with the sorts of inequality problems that Piketty helps, you know, people really sort of recognize, and the growing problem with programs that are designed to lift those at the bottom.
So, you know, just to be clear, the idea of that, you know, taxation may do something on the top end, and something like, particularly like the estate tax, I think is one of those mm-hmm. things that sort of prevents us from having an aristocracy. But if you really want to tackle inequality, you have to, in conjunction maybe with some other government policies that would strengthen people's ability to unionize and leverage their bargaining power in the economy, you got to spend that money is basically what it comes down to, right? I mean, it's a two-part process. And if you just stop at the taxation and you say we're going to cut the deficit, it doesn't really have the impact that you want to have other than maybe preventing an aristocracy.
That's exactly right. I agree completely with that.
And I should say that I also think, you know, there is a path there, but it's more of a political argument on some level. When you tax the high end, you decrease their ability to direct what the policy outcomes are ultimately with our government. And I am obviously not the first to say that either, but you keep the plutocracy, plutonomy from becoming a plutocracy.
Right, yeah. So this is another important way of using taxes to influence the social and economic outcomes. Absolutely. So it's not that you have to tax the very wealthy in order to get dollars, because, you know, some people, I read a piece the other day, and the argument was that in order to help the poor, we must tax the rich, that because apparently money grows on rich people, and that's where dollars come from. And so we cannot possibly do anything until we have the acquiescence of those at the very top to higher taxes, which seems to me pretty implausible at this point if Congress is more or less working in the service of those at the very top of the income scale, that why would you want to delay helping those at the bottom until such time as you can get those at the top to agree to higher taxes? I mean, I don't like the idea at all of setting it up that way. But are there good reasons to raise taxes on those at the very top? Absolutely. Should you tie those reasons to funding and make helping those at the bottom contingent on raising taxes on those at the top? I don't think so. I think that's a mistake.
All right, and I know we've held you for quite a while, and I appreciate, but let me just bear with me here. Do you think that there is a growing understanding, maybe at the Fed or in other policy circles, of this dynamic, that we can actually spend at a time where demand is still so lagging, that we can spend without raising taxes? I mean, this is where the economics and the politics sort of cross intersect on some level, that if there becomes a growing urgency, which I don't know that we'll see, in terms of what needs to be done in the economy, that policymakers will sort of accept this notion that we can actually spend without having to deal with the political implications of trying to raise taxes. Do you have any hope that that message is getting there's some sympathy to that notion in our policy circles?
Well, I always have hope because it keeps me crawling out of bed every day to try to continue to help people understand this stuff. But it's really tough. I think that for me, over the years that I've been doing this, I've come to sort of believe that it's got to come from the bottom up. It's better to try to educate regular Americans and to then have them apply pressure. So when they write to their, you know, congressman and they say, listen, my town needs or my state needs or whatever, and the congressman responds, oh, I'd really love to help you, and gosh, I agree, that's a worthy project, but, you know, we don't have any money. So how are you going to pay for it? Question. That is, you know, the first line of defense against anything, whether it's infrastructure, education, healthcare, whatever it is, you got to get over that hurdle. How are you going to pay for it? And they, you know, they put their hands up and they say, well, we'd love to help you, but of course there's no money. So as worthy as this is, I have to say no. And the more that constituents turn on them and say, please don't tell me that you don't know where to get the U.S. dollar, okay, because I know where it comes from. And so tell me that you can't and won't spend on this project because you're worried that it's going to be inflationary, because you think that if we try to get the real resources mobilized to fix our infrastructure, that we're going to put too much strain on the economy and we're going to end up with inflation. That I can accept, but don't tell me that you don't know where to come up with the dollar, okay, because that I reject. And so I'm seeing more and more pieces in everything from local newspapers to magazines. People, I think, are waking up to this, and I think the more that message spreads, the more difficult it's going to be for people in Congress to say, you know, no, because it's an affordability question. It's not an affordability question. We've got to get our elected officials focused on what really matters, and that is, do we have the real resources in the economy? Do they exist? Do we have the people? Do we have the raw materials? Do we have the machines and the factories? Is there enough of that sort of stuff that if a government wanted to put those resources to work, move them around in the economy by providing the money, then can we do something significant without causing an inflation problem? And that's the bottom line.
Stephanie Kelton, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics, Editor-in-Chief of the New Economic Perspectives. We will link to that on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Speaking of performance artists in Austin, Texas. In Travis County, there's a custody case. There's a jury. Apparently, this is a very messy divorce. I generally don't have much interest in these things. But Alex Jones and his ex-wife, Kelly, have been locked in a child custody battle for, I guess, like almost four years. Over the course of a divorce. And there's going to be a trial in Austin, 2 weeks. Anybody wants to sit in that trial and call in and give us some highlights, please do. Lawyers for Kelly Jones will argue that Jones's public outbursts suggest he's not a fit parent. And let me make it clear, I am agnostic in this respect.
I would imagine so.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I would want. I don't know if what I would do on this show, you know, this is not, I'm not parenting. I'm doing a radio show.
Do you tell your kids that you got to jump when you're done reading to them?
Yes, I do. Okay. I know, look, we got to jump. We got to do this quick. We got to wrap this up. But, the attorney for Alex Jones said, using his client Alex Jones's on-air InfoWars persona to evaluate Alex Jones as a father would be like judging Jack Nicholson in a custody dispute based on his performance as the Joker in Batman. He's playing a character, well, it said of Jones. He's a performance artist. Now, how I am on this show is not radically different from how I am off air. But you could say that I'm on air, Sam, now, as opposed to normally. But the idea that I'm playing a fictional character, right, where, you know, there are lines written for me that I don't accept as coming from me. You know, I said this when Andrew Breitbart died. He may be a very good dad or whatnot, good husband or, you know, nice son or brother or whatever he was. But in terms of how I know him, in his public persona, he was a horrible human being who really enhanced misery for people in a myriad of different ways. And so I judge him as a horrible human being and say, I'm glad that in the role that I knew Andrew Breitbart, that he's no longer with us. I appreciate that, you know, he played a different role with his family, but I don't know him in that way. And I wouldn't comment and know of his death if he had only been a guy who was just a good dad.
Actually, Sam, ironically, in the nature of transparency, also a terrible father.
Yes. But, and I don't think, like, you know, if you were ever in a divorce home, people like, have you heard him do Nelson Mandela?
Nelson Mandela.
Clearly doing character.
A guy cannot take care of children.
But when, but Kelly Jones says he's not a stable person. She said of the man with whom her 14-year-old son, 9 and 12-year-old daughters have lived since their 2015 divorce. He says he wants to break Alec Baldwin's neck. He wants J-Lo to get raped. I'm sorry, if you say these things, and the name of your character that you're saying them is the same name as you, and it's not really differentiated by, you've got to own it.
It's not InfoWars hosted by insane asshole who says grotesque things in character.
I'm concerned that he's engaged in felonious behavior, threatening a member of Congress, she said. He broadcasts from home. The children are there watching him broadcast. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if the guy should not have custody of his kids because of this. But I do know that, I'm sorry, you can't pretend like this is a made-up character that somebody else is writing for you. You got to own this. This is not a movie that's clearly fictional. You've got to own it. And you've got to own your public persona. That's who you are to the vast majority of people who even know who you're talking about. What did he say to his wife?
Like, he goes, Alex Jones. Like,
if you ever,
Kay,
if you ever think that I would allow you to take my kids from me.
Don't you know that's an impossibility?
That's an impossibility.
That could never happen. That I would do everything in my power.
Do you really want Mike Cernovich sitting on your doorstep?
Do you really want Roger Stone to contract a Moldovan hacker to say that you're a female pedophile?
I have one word to tell you. Plutonium. Plutonium.
I actually think what I thought was interesting about it, though, was that, like, it makes sense to me that I'm sure that there is, in his case, some version of on and off air Alex Jones. But in some ways, like,
oh, there's no doubt.
There's no doubt.
Well, you've got to own what you say.
Well, not only that, but in a certain way, it's like, and that becomes its own version of a compelling case. Like, this guy is so cynical and so kind of flippant in a way that in character, quote unquote, you know, he'll shill for ridiculous projects. He'll, you know, threaten a member of Congress. I mean, there's an angle there, too.
I don't know, for a divorce.
But he shouldn't have his kids taken away from him unless it's like.
Call him from a 610 area code. Who's this?
We say how soon is too soon? I guess it's not too soon to watch Alex Jones. This is a great Alex Jones clip because this is like how Alex Jones apparently interacts with his top secret sources. And then this is one of his lackeys. What's his name? Paul Joseph Watson. And what's really funny here is that Paul Joseph Watson, who's obviously made a career as a soft alt-right Twitter guy and an Alex Jones lackey, he's a little uncomfortable by just how obvious Alex Jones is making the false flag, secret Antifa, ISIS, whatever the hell it is, angle on the horrific events of Las Vegas. Let's take a look.
It could turn out to be, it wasn't left wing, it wasn't right wing, it wasn't an Islamic terrorist, it was just a mindless act of evil. It does happen sometimes where you just get mentally deranged people who are hopped up on whatever SSRI drugs. You know, the Batman shooter, he claimed he was motivated by a movie.
All right, let me stop you.
He wanted to become the Joker.
Let me stop you. We've got breaking news here, Paul Watson. that's absolutely critical, absolutely key. I have gotten this. No cameras, please, guys. No cameras.
No cameras.
This is from a law enforcement source. And the information is the news is lying. FBI HRT did the hit on the guy. And they found Antifa information in the room and photos of the woman in the Middle East. So he did not kill himself. The FBI hostage rescue team killed him because he was firing on them. So he did not want to be taken alive. And reportedly he did it. And it was Antifa crap everywhere. And other things I'm not supposed to mention. That is directly from the hostage rescue team, by the way, Paul. And I'm going to delete this information now. Keep going.
Well, obviously, that's huge. That's huge if it turns out to be true.
Yeah, hey, Paul. Because... Paul. This is from high-level CIA. Right here. That's what it's directly from. And this is from the hostage rescue team. You know I don't make sources up. Go ahead.
No, all I'm saying is that I'm going on the information I have, and I don't know.
No, absolutely, really absolutely. I'm just saying this is big breaking news. This is huge. In fact, you go ahead and take over the next 4 minutes. You host. I'm going to run in here and get with the writers. Go.
Matt. This is my sources. I didn't even understand that one. Because he's it wasn't a false flag. It actually did. The guy was actually doing it, but he was Antifa. But the whole thing was set up. And why? I like how Watson's just like the best thing about Alex Jones. I don't think that there is anybody else who telegraphs themselves as much as he. Like I don't make up sources.
Yeah.
And literally every like Watson sitting there like, Jesus, Alex, could you at least like fucking like pretend. Like, when you make up sources, could you not do it in real time? But what was the theory there? Did you catch that?
Well, I guess basically the media, for some reason, and the cops, because the cops love to cover for Antifa.
Yeah,
the
cops love Antifa, yes.
They're Seinfeld extras, not real cops. Apparently went to, like, I don't know, Office Max or something, and printed off a bunch of Antifa like literature, like whatever like punch Nazis, is that it?
And like reading block manifestos from the '80s while he was like a retired real estate speculator who spent his life in casinos, and then it's like
brought pictures of his whoever his partner is in the Middle East. Like, let's bring the most incriminating.
She's there in him. Look at her in Raqqa. Ah. Oh. Jesus. Okay.
Gentlemen, look, we've got to get to this because this is important. This is important. This is both a warning and I think could be a piece of evidence in the next Alex Jones custody case. I want you to know you're hearing this second here. If you heard it on Alex Jones' show, you would have heard it first. But you're hearing it second. And here is Alex Jones giving us all a warning of what is coming, ladies and gentlemen.
The elite psychopaths, they are seeing all this and are testing it on us and now really do have massive life extension. They've got stuff that's AI. It's just not self-aware, but it's artificially intelligent. And what we know they've got is so advanced that that's why they act like we don't even exist now. They've got a plan. They're carrying it out. And they don't want us to be aware of it or to have any culture.
All right, pause it for 1 second. Let me just, I hate to ruin the fun of this segment. So let me get this over with first. Understand that when Alex Jones says the elite, they don't care about this because they have AI, they have life extension, they have all of these, they have the weather machine, they have all these things, these magical things that make them not have to care about us, that we're just basically, you know, like those eggs in the matrix that just provide them energy. The problem with this construct is that while he's right, they don't care about us. When you start to lard it up with, because they have all of these special robots and magic machines and secret cults where they drink each other's blood and then, you know, change into lizards or whatnot.
Very tasty.
You are obscuring the fact that really what it is quite simple. They have amassed so much money and wealth and power that they don't need to worry about us. And they are doing it not through weather machines and not through, you know, secret rites that, you know, where everybody's like praising an owl or whatever the fuck it is. They're doing it simply by things like rolling back the estate tax. They are doing by destroying unions. They're disempowering workers. They are doing about it by deregulating. They are doing about it by amassing capital in a myriad of different ways that we as a society are basically making a choice and allowing them to do this. And when Alex Jones gets out there and starts talking about weather machines and this and that, all it does is disempowers and makes his dumb followers sheep. Dumber, I guess.
That's what kills me about the Alex Jones people. Like, they're on the right track. Like, they're right not to trust these people. But then they go way off into
life. I have always said that if Alex Jones didn't exist, the CIA would have invented him. And, all right, now let's get to the fun part, because this is serious.
They don't want us to be aware of it or to have any culture. And people that are part of it are scared, and they're there dutifully following their orders. You watch those Google, Facebook, and Twitter executives in those hearings attacking InfoWars. They were scared of Congress, and they were scared, and they were there like little scientists. Yes, sir, we're doing it. Program operational, yes. We're going to shut them down, don't worry. Because they've been dialed in, okay? They want themselves to be safe. That's why almost none of them have families.
That's right.
Because they're saying no one in the EU leadership now has children, except for five countries that are pulling out of it. They all have kids. All the major elites don't have children now, ladies and gentlemen. Because they've been told you may not get access into the ARC centers, the below ground facilities and places during this if you got kids. And we don't want your kids there. They're like, we understand. I mean, we're close, folks. None of them are having kids. Because they wouldn't put kids through what's about to happen.
Pause it. We're going to go backwards. I want to make something absolutely clear, too. Their plan is to live forever. So they don't need kids to continue on with the species. That's why. So they go down to the ARC Center, they get their energy pills, they live forever, and they don't need kids. They're not going to need that, because then we're also going to be turned into floating orbs. All right, but continue.
Kids. Because they wouldn't put kids through what's about to happen. I'm having more. I'm putting everything I got on the table. I'm going to have more children. We're going into this. We're going to win. I'm putting everything on the line. I'm not a coward. I'm having more. And I love them more than my life 1,000 times. And that's why I love them enough to put them on the table so they have a future. And I'm not going to give up on humanity just because these sick psychopaths have decided to bring in world government and kill everybody.
I want to make something absolutely clear, too. I'm putting my children on the table because I own them. They're my chips. They're my chips. I'm putting them on the table. I'm putting it all in. I'm going to have more children. More children.
And then they'll say he has a narcissistic personality disorder. Because of globalists.
That's right.
Where did that come from? What's that fucking kid?
Did he lose custody of his children in that divorce fight? Do we know?
I believe so.
And maybe part of it has to do with the fact that he's putting them on the table as if they were like poker chips or a couple of quarters.
Look, having white kids right now is very dangerous. Black kids will be allowed underground. Not little chubby ones from Texas.
I would like to see the dating profile or Craigslist ad that Alex Jones puts up seeking someone to bear these children.
Are you kidding me? Alex Jones is going to clean up.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to. I ejaculate into a bottle of super beta male vitality, and it grows.
Super beta male
grows
vitality.
Out of.
That was a Freudian slip.
Super beta male vitality? What is it? Alpha male? We've got everything. We've got A through Z. Zeta mentality.
Zeta mentality.
We've got all of it.
That's what I want. That sounds very relaxed, man. Zeta mentality.
We just grow them in an incubator here in the studios. Completely impromptu.
Baby, I need you.
The way I got into that.
Baby, I want you back.
The way I got into that formula. Completely impromptu.
Baby, I need you back.
That was a completely impromptu
masturbation session.
Alex Jones will probably end up being like one of the only major figures in media to not be sexually harassing his staff. He'll be too busy taking care of shit.
I would be very surprised if there were even women working there.
Yeah. Why would there be women working here?
I mean,
the Mike Pence rule, unprompted.
I would be surprised. It would surprise me if he was.
You know, I want to say something. I think Brendan and I were talking about this. We make a lot of comments, and a lot of people make a lot of comments, actually more nasty comments than we do, that the sort of before and after photos that he posts up of these miracle products don't usually show a before and after, which was one of
what happens on the inside.
The most amazing Alex Jones things imaginable. But when he was in Seattle and the guy called him like a, you know, an asshole or something, and he sprinted at him, he had real legs. I had never, like, that guy knows how to move.
Well,
and I had never, ever seen anything from Alex Jones before that would indicate any type of athletic capacity. But the way he sprinted after that guy was very impressive.
Huge athlete. Of course,
so
he got
might
you.
Be maybe
complete training.
Maybe
held to every size, Michael.
Ooh. Only you could do turn an Alex Jones joke into a reverse judo accusation of fat shaming. I see you. I see you, Miss Woke.
Oh, I was there.
I will not be taken down. He ran really well.
Yeah, I was there when he took a swing at a chink in Cleveland, too.
Wait, he took a swing? I didn't see that. I never even heard that he took a swing.
Right, he took a swing. He sort of came into the thing.
He didn't take a swing at chink.
He menaced him.
Menaced him.
Jank was there going like, "We hate Saudi Arabia more than anybody." And Alex Jones is just there like, "This is great TV. All right, everybody, keep it on the field. Keep it on the field."
What do you say, time for a beer now?
Guys want a drink?
I don't actually.
More clicks for everybody. I mean, to be honest with you, I think Obama did a pretty good job managing the economy.
Guys, I want you to have this. I give you a little.
Yeah, there's two women.
There's two women.
Alex Jones is probably totally cool and sane offset.
I don't think that's true.
I do.
I don't think that's true.
Oh, he totally is.
I think, listen, this is the thing, is that...
how are you monetizing your show? Oh, that's cool.
It's
a grassroots model.
I don't want to... I don't want people to take this literally, because I'm only using this as a metaphor. Let me put it that way. But... metaphorically speaking, let's say you were Gary Busey, and you can be both out of your mind, metaphorically,
and also monetize
it, and have a level of self-awareness to monetize it,
right?
And also be out of your mind.
Capitalism wouldn't reward antisocial behavior, Sam.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's no place for antisocial disorders in capitalism.
I think he's probably so paranoid around the office that at the very least, like, he probably...
But I'm going beyond the no harassment thing. I'm saying you meet him and he's literally like, "Yeah, how long have you been doing Majority Report for?"
No, I don't.
I remember you at Sex in the City. Yeah, it was good work.
Yeah.
All right, let's go do the segment.
Listen, guys.
You're trying to kill my children.
That was
okay, and that's over. You know what? That was really good.
That was a great fake fight. I want you guys to each have a special complimentary bottle. This is actually my signature stuff. It's pretty good.
Sane Alex Jones.
Sane Alex Jones.
Wackiest character yet.
Right, exactly.
I give you guys this. This is my special reserve. It has 43% less lead than the other stuff.
I just think the problem is with gun
control. No heavy metals. That one I actually don't have manufacturing.
The base is so fervent that they'll never have any common sense proposals. We're on air? You're trying to kill my children.
Hi, folks. Sam Seder here. We still need your help on our Patreon page. YouTube ads have come back, but not nearly as much as we had before. So if you can help us out, any little bit helps. Head over to our Patreon page right at this URL, and you'll help us keep helping you by making videos.